So an emotionally destructive marriage may also, in addition to this power, control, power over someone, may also include chronic deceit, chronic dependency, and chronic indifference. And I'm not going to take a lot of time to unpack that. But when we see a lot of addiction, lying, a lot of deceit in financial mismanagement, those are things that are being reported. I can't trust him. I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. Suspect an emotionally destructive marriage. When there's a lot of indifference, we don't talk about this biblically of not caring, but when you promise someone that you're going to care, that's what the marriage vows say, I will care about you. And when we're chronically, I'm not saying every moment we have to show care, nobody can do that, but when we have a pattern of uncaring, it's as if we're saying to our partner, you don't matter enough to me for me to invest my time, my energy, or my money in helping or caring for you. So let me give you an example of indifference that, is so poignant. So a client of mine, her husband was very indifferent. Their house was a mess in terms of repairs. He had plenty of money in the bank. Like, he made a ton of money. It wasn't a money issue. But they had no working shower or sink in their house. The toilet barely worked. Their kitchen was falling apart. The house was falling apart, and he would not pay to have anything done. He wouldn't do anything. So that was indifferent to her need to have a functional, it didn't have to be a beautiful, but even a functional house. So he was always doing his own thing, playing like a single man, doing just sports, all kinds of stuff. So she's working in the yard, digging up roots that were needing to get undug from the yard, and he's in the driveway heading off to one of his baseball games, and she dug a bee's nest. Sometimes bees, are in the ground, so she hit a bee's nest. So the bees came flying at her, and so she's running down the driveway as he's pulling out of the driveway, trying to get these bees off of her head, like running, like frantically, and he's pulling out of the driveway, laughing at her as she's going down the road. She had to drive herself to the emergency room, face full of bee stings, comes home, never said a word. Not how are you, not you look terrible, not what can I do to help you, not I'm sorry I left. Now, biblically, how do we look at this? It's abusive. It's abusive. Do we have a biblical category that says she can divorce him for this not caring? Well, it depends on how you see it theologically, but it is abusive, this indifference. And this was just one incident. There were plenty of others. Woke up in the middle of the night, needed to go to the hospital. Her husband told her to call her mother. He didn't want to drive her. Just terrible indifference of uncaring that is very, very painful. So crazy-making behaviors. These are when you are told your reality is off, that what you see isn't what you see, what you hear isn't what you hear. This would be a really quick example of crazy making. So a husband never comes home on time. His wife says, as any wife would, can you please call me when you're going to be late? Okay, I'll call you. So then he comes home and he didn't call, and she says, you didn't call. He goes, you're being so controlling. I'm not being controlling. You told me you would... I didn't tell you I'd call you. All right, so that starts, I thought we agreed on that. Did we agree on that? When that happens over and over and over again, you start to doubt your own perceptions. I remember seeing a woman who was brought to counseling by her husband, who was a very large ministry leader in our area where I used to live, and he said she was depressed, she was menopausal and going through midlife crisis. She said, he's probably right. But what I think is he's having an affair with his ministry partner, and I'm insecure, and I don't like it. But I've told him, and he swears that's not happening. He promises me that, he loves me, and he's there for me, and blah, blah, blah. But, 8 months later, after she's getting all this help, it turns out she was right. She was right. But her perceptions were correct, but he kept telling her she was making things up, she was seeing things, she was imagining things, she was, paranoid, and she started to think she must be, because he was such a godly man and such a man above a reproach. How dare you accuse me of these things? It's you. That is emotionally destructive when you begin to doubt your own perceptions on things. So, in summary, an emotionally destructive relationship is one and where one's personhood, dignity, and freedom of choice is regularly denied, criticized, or crushed. And this can be done through words, behaviors, economics, or the scriptures. Let me just go through some statistics really quickly. It's not in your handout too much for that, but I just want to give you a bird's-eye picture of it. It's the number one health problem for women today in our country. Domestic violence, the Surgeon General says, every 9 seconds a woman is battered in the United States. Domestic abuse is the leading cause of injury to women between the ages of 15 and 44, more than car accidents, muggings, and rapes combined. Here's some headlines of pastor kills wife to marry gay lover. Houston pastor accused of killing wife. Pastor shot wife and daughter before stabbing himself. I just got the pastor ones because I just thought that might be interesting to some of you. A church invited me to come in to speak because their pastor murdered the second wife. But they found out that the first wife, after she fell down the stairs and died, probably didn't fall down the stairs accidentally. And so the church was really shook. I mean, this pastor had been their pastor for like 30 years. They knew the first wife and the second wife. And so it's very, very upsetting to not know who he was. 4 million women report domestic abuse every year. Those don't report are even more. 3.3 million children witness violence toward their mothers. And let me just say this, there is trauma on children living in an environment like that, even if they're not victims of abuse. You know, we tell ourselves that let's keep the marriage together for the sake of the children. Let me tell you, maybe it's not better for the children. It actually rewires their brains. It rewires their neural circuitry. And we talk about the sins of the father being passed on to the next generation. Sometimes that's exactly what happens. And so sometimes it's not better for the children. I was doing a webinar last week. We had 2,500 people sign up for this webinar. About 800 were live. One of them that we were doing, they were 800 live on the webinar. And I asked them, I said, I had no idea who they were or what they were going to say. And so we were talking about, is it better to stay? And I said, those of you who stayed in an emotionally destructive marriage, whatever it was, whatever degree it was, for the sake of the children, and your children are now grown, do you have any regrets? And I would say 95% of them typed in, oh my gosh, if I had to do it differently, I would not have stayed. It has totally affected my children in terrible ways. Suicidal, repeating the sins in their next generation. So don't for a minute think that for the sake of the children, it's better to stay. In a disappointing marriage, absolutely for the sake of the children, it's better to stay. In a destructive marriage, not so true. This is interesting. Violent youth, so if you work with youth, if you're a youth pastor, are 4 times more likely to come from homes in which their fathers beat their mothers than nonviolent youth, because they learn from their dads that violence works. This is also pretty scary. 63% of young men between the ages of 11 and 20 who are serving time for murder are there because they killed their mother's abuser, whether it was their father or their stepmother, the stepfather or their mother's boyfriend. One of the first scariest calls I got was from a woman who was in my area. She wasn't my client, but her son was threatening to kill his father because, again, he was a policeman, the man. He was also an elder in the church. He was a policeman. He wore guns at home, like he wore his holster. So talk about power and control, right? And he had a rule that his wife wasn't allowed to go to bed without him. So no matter how tired she was, she had to stay up however late he stayed up, and he worked all kinds of crazy shifts. So he'd stay up really late sometimes because he could sleep late. She couldn't, but he didn't want her to go to bed without him. So one night she's just so tired, she went up was going up the stairs to go to bed anyway, and he pulled her hair down the stairs and proceeded to hit her, and their teenage son came flying down the stairs with one of his guns from upstairs and was threatening to shoot his father. So that's what precipitated her phone call to me. But this couple had been in biblical counseling for the last year and a half, and the counselor had no idea what was going on. So this is how serious it can be that we're not knowing what we're not knowing. And 1 in 4 Christian women report being in an emotionally destructive marriage, not a disappointing marriage. So if you think of your congregation and you have 200 families out there, 50 of them, are in destructive marriages. And if you doubt me, if you're a church leader, pastor here, I challenge you. If you speak on marriages or on Mother's Day or Father's Day, and you speak and you talk about, hey, if any of you are being mistreated by your spouse, and I'm not talking about hit, I'm talking about if your husband calls you names, if he degrades you, if he scares you, if he doesn't let you make decisions, you come talk to me. Your phone is going to ring off the hook the next day. When you give permission for someone to tell, and they can do it safely, they'll start coming to you. When they don't think they can do it safely, they won't. This is another interesting statistic if you work with children. 40% of girls ages 14 to 17 know someone their age who's been hit or beaten by her boyfriend. Do you have a teaching time for teens about dating relationships? 1 in 3 teenage girls have feared for her safety in a dating relationship. So quickly, I want to talk about how do we look at domestic abuse biblically so that we can, when you get my treatment plan for the couple and for the individuals, it makes sense biblically, all right? I'm really committed to biblical principles. I'm not taking anything from the psychological world that isn't verified by biblical principles. And so I want you to know that God does say something about this. And so how do we look at biblically? First of all, it's sin. It's sin. It is never an appropriate response to being provoked. And this is the excuse making you'll get in counseling. So, here's an example. How would you handle this? Couple sitting before you, there's been some low-level abuse. There was an incident. You don't really like her very much because she's kind of not a likable woman. You like him better, even though he's the abuser. But she's a cantankerous woman at times. So, here's the situation in the marriage counseling. She's a type A woman. She's got 6 kids. She homeschools them. He's a very thoughtful, sensitive man who would just like his wife once in a while, maybe once a week, twice a week at the most, to give him 15 to 30 minutes of undivided attention where they could just talk. Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? There's nothing sinful what he wants. He's not trying to, you know, control all of her time or manage her whole life. He just wants her to sit down and talk with him for 15 or 20 minutes when she's not folding laundry, when she's not multitasking. She's just looking at him and smiling at him and listening to him. That's what he would like. And she can't do it. She doesn't want to do it. She's too busy doing all of her stuff. Right? So you've got this tension. So they had this incident where she didn't, and he was so angry, he pushed her to the ground and kicked her and spit at her. Didn't leave any injuries, but it was inappropriate. He comes, it was inappropriate, I was wrong, he's crying, I'm so sorry, I feel horrible about myself, and she's, I don't know if I'm going to stay with him. What would you do as a counselor? What would you do as a counselor? It's very tempting in that moment to turn to her and say, why couldn't you just listen to him for 15 or 20 minutes? Right? Who wouldn't do that? What's wrong with doing that? What's the counseling error in that strategy with this kind of couple? Okay, so you're reinforcing his idea that she should do that, and you might want to reinforce that to her later by herself, but you're reinforcing it in front of him that he had a legitimate reason for doing what he did. And that it's her job to make sure she does what she needs to do so he doesn't act that way. Right? Terrible counsel. So what do you do instead? So this is what I did with him. I turned to him and I said, I totally validated him. I said, so what you're saying to me is that you're so hurt that your wife just is too busy for you, that she is preoccupied, that she's exhausted, that she's, you know, got other priorities, and you're hurt, and all you want is for your wife to just sit and listen to you. Okay. So what happens to you when you don't get what you want? Right? I mean, isn't that the million-dollar question? Whoever gets what they want all the time? Right? I don't get everything I want in marriage, do you? My husband doesn't do what I want all the time. Does that give me a right to abuse him? Or lose my temper and be cursive or destructive or abusive? No. And so if he truly wants to be a godly man, that he says he does, because he's the elder of the church and all of that, and he's repentant, or at least he says he is, and he's crying, he's going to have to put his wants in order. And do you want to be a godly man when you don't get what you want from your wife? Or not? because he behaved like getting what he wanted was more important than being a godly man, right? And so by offering him that option to reflect on that gives him a choice to say, oh, I don't have to act that way when I don't. I can be legitimately disappointed without being abusive. And to look at that and work on that. But to turn to her is a mistake. It gives him the feeling like I was provoked. Here's another tool I use in my counseling office, and I didn't get a chance to fix it as well as I would have liked to because I traveled with it, but I have this bottle of water in my office. And so when someone's arguing like, well, if she wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have done this, or he did this and I did, I lied because she did this, you know, all of that. You hear that? How many hear? You hear that? Okay. So I pull out this bottle of water and I say, watch what happens when I provoke this water. And I'll shake it up. And I'll say, did shaking this make it dirty? And some of them will go, yeah. And I'll say, well, actually, that's not true. Shaking it just showed you the dirt that was on the bottom. It was always there. I just held it by my hand there. You didn't see it. But shaking it just exposed the dirt. And Jesus says the same thing about us when he says, it is out of the overflow of your heart that your mouth speaks. So what happens when you're shaken? If dirt comes out, it's because dirt was in. Right? I mean, if this water was clear, I could shake it till my arm fell off. It would still be clear. Right? So when we're provoked, and we might be, it's exposing what's going on inside of us. I want my way. I want control. I want to punish you. I want to hurt you for hurting me. Whatever it is, it's exposing us. And if we're not seeing that, as counselors especially, and helping them own that, then they can't change. Right? And so don't allow the blame shifting to happen. Biblically, God doesn't allow us to do that. Even when Moses tried to do it. When Moses lost his temper, what did he say? Those Israelites, right? And he was right. Those Israelites were provocative. They did do horrible things. And who did God hold accountable? Moses. Moses. Okay, so it's never an appropriate response to being provoked. Domestic violence is not about headship and submission issues. We've already talked about that a little bit. God's heart is always for the oppressed and against the oppressor. God never is on the side of the oppressor. And so how do we respond biblically? Here's the verse that I took from my treatment plan where it says in Romans 12:21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. So what does that look like? First, Proverbs 27:12 says it is good to protect yourself from violent people. So safety is important. Second, Ephesians 5:11, it is good to expose deeds done in darkness. So talking about it is fine. You're not dishonoring your husband if you say what he did to you. 4:25 in Ephesians, it is good to speak the truth in love. Confrontation is important. And how you do it is important. It is good to stop someone from sinning against you when possible. Matthew 18, James 5, and Proverbs 19. It is good for someone to experience the consequences of his or her behavior. Galatians 6, 7, what you sow, you reap. Genesis 2, 42 through 45, it is good to see the fruit of repentance before reconciling. We have a good example of that with Joseph and his brothers. Joseph was not overcome by his brother's evil. He overcame evil with good. He still was gracious. He forgave them. He fed them. But he did not reconcile with them, did he? Until he saw he could trust them. And then he saw he could trust them, and then he was open to reconcile. Remember, he planted all those little silver coins in the bags, and he tested whether his brothers were going to throw him under the bus, to Benjamin under the bus, because they had done that with him, being the younger brother and the favorite brother. So he tested them to see if they had changed. And only when he discerned that they had changed, he saw the fruits of repentance, was he willing to reconcile and enter back into relationship with him. That's going to be key in the healing process, because trust has been broken severely in a destructive relationship. And trust has to be rebuilt. It's not granted, it's rebuilt. And if it's not rebuilt, the reconciliation cannot take place. It is still good to be gracious to your enemy. So how do we teach a woman to be gracious to an abuser without enabling him to sin against her? And it is good to pursue your own good and the good of others in 1 Thessalonians 5:15. So there is nothing sinful or selfish about a woman pursuing her own good and saying, I need safety and I need to protect my heart and I need to protect myself against his deception, against his financial mismanagement, against his abusive behavior and my children. And it's not only good for me, it's good for him. It's good for him to wake up. It's good for him to see the errors of his ways so he can repent. And so when we help a woman do these things, we're not just teaching her to be a reactor to what her husband does, but we're teaching her to learn how to respond in a way that's godly and good. All right? Make sense? So let's real quickly go through what a godly marriage is, because as much as I would like to think that all of you know that, growing up in an abusive home with an ungodly marriage gave me some unrealistic pictures of what marriage was like, and we all watch kind of crazy movies, and Hollywood and Harlequin just pick relationships that are not necessarily healthy. And so I want to just talk quickly what a biblical healthy marriage looks like, so that if you know what a healthy marriage is, you more quickly can spot an unhealthy marriage, right? If you know what a godly marriage is supposed to look like, you can more quickly spot the ungodly marriages. And again, there's going to be ungodly marriages in your home. The problem is when we spot them and we talk about them and we see them and they're coming to us for counseling, can we talk to them about it, or are they all defensive and argumentative and blaming everybody else? That is an indicator that it's more of a destructive marriage than just an ordinary everybody's in the same boat marriage. All right, so a godly marriage is loving partnership. It's not a slave-master relationship or a parent child relationship. There's this equality of status in the relationship. Conflict involves solving a problem, not attacking a person. And damages are going to happen because you've got two sinners who are imperfect people living together, right? So damages occur and they're repaired through confession, restitution, and change. They also contain three ingredients which are essential for all healthy relationships: mutuality, reciprocity, and freedom. So mutuality means that both people in the relationship bring certain ingredients that are necessary for the care and the maintenance of that relationship, like mutual caring, mutual honesty, mutual respect, mutual responsibility for the care and the maintenance of the relationship, as well as mutual repentance. Now, I think this gets confusing in the Christian realm a little bit because we talk about servanthood. And we talk about, you know, we're not supposed to look for anything that's in it for us, and we're just supposed to care for people and give to them and give to them and give to them. And there's a big element of truth to that, but it's usually called ministry, right? We have ministry relationships with people. But if we're going to have close personal relationships, there has to be more mutuality to it. So I was speaking at Liberty University a year or so ago, and a student came up to me after we were speaking about healthy relationships, and he said, I'm having a problem with my roommate. He said, you know, I'm trying to be a servant. I'm trying to be a godly man. You know, I'm helping my roommate as much as I can. I let him borrow my car. He was sick last week. I brought him dinner from the cafeteria. Sometimes he misses classes and I give him my notes. I even washed his clothes one time because they were all over the floor. But, you know, he never offers to reciprocate. He doesn't, you know, I was sick a couple weeks ago. He never offered to help me. You know, he doesn't put gas in my car. He never cleans up my messes. I'm getting kind of tired of the servant thing. And I said to him, well, your serving him is actually hurting him because it's enabling him to be more selfish and self-centered. So it's probably best at this point that you have a good conversation with him about your desire for a friendship. And a friendship requires some mutuality and reciprocity. And if he doesn't want to do that, then understand you can choose to minister to him however you want, but you're not going to be friends. Do you hear the difference? You're not going to have a friendship. Even Jesus didn't have friendships with everybody. He ministered to people, but he had friendships with people who gave something back to him. Remember his time with Mary and Martha and Lazarus? They fed him. They were talking to him. He had relaxed atmosphere. He had friendships with people, and he had ministry relationships. They weren't the same. And so in order to have a healthy marriage, there must be mutuality. And if there isn't, there's a lot of resentment that gets built up. All right? Second is, so Tim Keller says this. He says, a Christian teaching on marriage does not offer us a choice between fulfillment and sacrifice, but it's mutual fulfillment through mutual sacrifice. There's a mutuality to marriage. Reciprocity means power and responsibility are shared, not like Fred and Marie or some of the other couples that I've talked about. All right. So when you have a couple where there's a double standard of rules, I just had a lady call me the other day. I didn't know her out of the blue. She wanted to work with me as a coaching client. But she said what made her decide to work with her is her high school friend just got murdered by her husband. And what she said was he had rules for her to live by, and she signed the agreement. And because she failed, he killed her. Okay. So when you're in a relationship where rules are set by one person, not both people, there's a lack of reciprocity or shared power. So when you're listening in a counseling situation, maybe you've been working with a couple for years, but you know that he manages the money and she has no idea where it's going, or she doesn't have any say on certain things. This is red flags for you to say, you know what, maybe this isn't bronchitis of the marriage, maybe this is cancer of the marriage and I didn't pick up on it. There's no reciprocity. Or she has to be respectful, but I don't have to be respectful. She has to be accountable for the money, but I don't have to be accountable for the money. She has to tell me where she's going, but I don't have to tell her where I'm going. Do you hear the lack of balance there? If they both agree to the rules, they can have a 5-page rule book. It doesn't matter to me. But if only one person's making the rule book, and they don't have to follow the rules, only the other person, there's a real imbalance there. And that's a huge red flag for a destructive relationship. Even Paul talks about mutuality and reciprocity. He did in that verse in 1 Corinthians 7 where I said, likewise, with the sexual thing. But here about giving money. So here he's talking to church about giving money sacrificially, this whole servanthood idea. And here's what he says. He says, I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need so that their abundance may supply your need, that there might be fairness. He's talking about relationships among the churches. And he's saying, hey, one person isn't always the giver and the other person is always the taker. Yeah, sometimes you might be the giver because you have extra, and then they're going to be the giver because they have extra. There has to be this mutuality and fairness and reciprocity for relationships to work well. And the third ingredient is freedom. Freedom. We have to have the freedom to speak up, to be ourselves, to disagree, to have our own mind. We need to do it in a respectful way, for sure, if we're going to have healthy relationships. But if we can't be ourselves or talk about our feelings, I am out of battery juice, and apparently this plug is not activated because my computer's looking low, so can we get some tech help here so I can not lose my PowerPoint notes? I'm not sure why that plug's not working. Okay. So we need the freedom to be able to talk about what we're unhappy with, to make our own choices, or it's not a healthy relationship. So in summary, a healthy adult relationship is where both people in the relationship give and both receive. There's a safe, and it's still not on because my little light's not going on. Okay, great, thanks. There's a safe and open exchange of ideas and feelings, and all perspectives are considered and valued. And there's also the freedom to respectfully challenge, confront, as well as strengthen one another. So, if you're in a counseling situation, what do you listen for? Let's talk about that. I want you to listen for this imbalance of power and control in the relationship. How many of you can already think about couples that you're working with that, oh, I never saw it before, but now I'm starting to notice what I failed to notice? A consistent lack of mutuality. One's the giver, one's the taker. One's the apologizer, one's the repenter, the other one doesn't. Right? One's doing more to maintain the relationship than the other. A lack of freedom to speak up, to have an opinion that's different. You're disrespecting me if you disagree, or can make choices on their own. A consistent indifference to his or her partner's needs, feelings, desires, and thoughts. Blame shifting, minimizing, lack of responsibility for wrongs committed in the relationship, and an attitude of entitlement. Okay, an attitude of pushing to get one's own way and getting the counselor to, see, don't you agree? I had one guy who was taking over the session all the time. He was just completely, and so his wife wanted to talk about something. And he said, no, we're not talking about this. We're talking about that. Right? And immediately I know, okay, he's used to taking control. He's even taking control from me. Right? And I said, well, we don't work that way here. What do you mean we don't work that way here? I said, well, actually, I'm in control. So actually, I'd like to hear what she had to say. But that's not important. Well, it's important to me, right? And so at the end of the session, he goes, no one's ever talked to me that way before. And it was helpful to him. As I said to him, you're kind of a bully here. You're bullying her and you're bullying me. I don't like it. He was an executive. He was a CEO. He was used to telling everybody what to do. And nobody ever gave him that feedback that he was being a bully, except me. And if no one ever gives him the feedback, like the emperor's new clothes, how can he ever see what's going on? All right. We good? Great. So if this happens, what do you do? If you begin to notice, here are some helpful questions to ask. And I would not ask them together. All right? So here's how you separate them. If you've been seeing them for a while, and you start to say, I think I need to ask more questions, you will say to them in your next session, hey, I'm going to do something different next time. I'd like to work with, you know, I'd like to just do some, you know, digger deeping on some family origin of stuff, or I'd like to ask you some other questions that, you know, each of you don't need to be present, so I'm going to work with you next week and you the next week, or I'm going to work with you for half an hour and you for half an hour. So you're going to tell them that you're going to separate them. If it's the beginning of the counseling, you can say, one of the things I always do when working with couples is have a session with each of you individually. I'd like to just get to know you better, and I'd like to just ask you some questions about your family of origin, which you will. Okay, I'm not saying you're just making that up. You will ask them, but now you've got safety in the room that you can ask them these questions. And these are the questions that you want to know. One is, have you ever been threatened or physically hurt in this relationship? Now, you might have to reword it, but you might have to say, you know, I'm a little bit uncomfortable because I see that you don't talk much. You don't talk much in the session. You know, have you ever been afraid of your partner? So you might use different order of these questions in order to, based on what you've already seen and observed. But this is the information you need to know. Have you ever been threatened or physically hurt? Have you ever been an unwilling participant in a sexual act? Do you feel fearful around your partner? Are there times you don't trust your partner? Do you have, so the four, if they say yes, those are big red flags. The next two, if they say no, are red flags, okay? Do you have the freedom to make decisions, to give your input and say no to things? And can you respectfully challenge and confront the attitudes and decisions or behaviors of your partner? And if not, what happens when you've tried? That will give you a lot of information. If you hear yes to the last two or no to the last two and yes to the first four, now what? You're going to dig deeper. Okay? So now you're going to, whatever they disclosed, so let's just say she didn't feel safe. Do you ever not feel safe? Right? When was the first time you didn't feel safe? When was the last time you didn't feel safe? I'm sorry. When was the worst time you didn't feel safe? Describe a typical time you don't feel safe. Or when was the first time you felt threatened? What was the last time you felt threatened? Now, when you're doing this, so let's give you two examples. So you're working with a woman. She's been married 25 years. The first time she felt whatever was on their honeymoon. The last time she felt it was last week. Okay, the worst time was something, and a typical time was something. So what are you seeing? A pattern. What if she says the first time she felt it was on her honeymoon, and the last time she felt it was on her honeymoon, and she's been married 25 years? All right, then it was an incident. All right, so you're getting to see, is there this consistent pattern, and what does the pattern look like? Because in domestic abusive marriages, the pattern usually escalates in frequency and intensity. So it might have been he, you know, ditched her on the honeymoon and went off and drank with the buddies in the bar. And it might be that now he's been watching porn and wants her to join in on, you know, threesomes and whatever. And so you see it escalating in frequency and intensity. Or, you know, the first time was that he, you know, yelled at her and then he hit her, and then he pulled her hair and threw her to the ground, and then he choked her, and are you going to wait till he shoots her? I hope not. Right? So you're seeing this escalation of frequency. How often is it happening? How intense is it? How dangerous is it? And this is going to give you some idea. We'll talk after lunch probably about a safety plan, but this gives you a great picture of the patterns. Now, if you need help in learning to ask better questions in therapy, if you're not a good question maker, and the only questions you tend to ask are information questions, I'm giving you a free book that I wrote called The Art of Asking Great Questions. Just like that man who was, you know, debating about his wife not, and I said to him, so what happens to you when you don't get what you want? That wasn't an information question, that was a therapeutic question, right? So do we know how to make therapeutic questions? And so that book will help you, and so just download the lesliebernick.com free gift. I should have said it all in one line, but it says free gift there, all right? And that will give you that book, okay? And you can just download that. All right, so we want to take a careful history. Everybody got that down so I can switch? Oh, I did already. We want to take a careful history of the marriage, and we're looking for these patterns of healthy behaviors, of mutuality, reciprocity, and freedom, and we're also looking for the patterns of unhealthy behavior, often escalating in frequency and intensity. Now, I'm not going to have time to unpack this, but this is in my book, The Emotionally Destructive Relationship, not the one on marriage. Those books are different. Don't think it's just one package over another, a different cover. It's just not the same book. Same themes, but different stuff in each book. So in that first book, The Emotionally Destructive Relationship, what I did was I devoted two chapters. Instead of talking about like narcissism and borderline and all of the other things that psychologists might talk about, I took some of the same behaviors, because what psychologists do is they look at behaviors and themes and someone's behavior that looks like this over time, and then they put a label on it, like depression or anxiety or personality disorder like narcissism. So I just took the Bible and looked at behaviors and saw what God labeled it. And we did two chapters of those things. So there's a heart of pride, a heart of selfishness, a heart of anger, an envious heart, lazy heart, fearful heart, evil heart. Sort of an offshooting, somewhat of the seven deadly sins. Now, all of us have those heart problems. It's not that we're exempt from a proud, prideful heart or a selfish heart. The difference between a destructive person diagnostically when you're working with them and an ordinary sinner is that an ordinary sinner, when you say to them, these are some of the issues you're dealing with, they will listen and respond, yes, I see it. A destructive person, when you talk about their anger or their selfishness or their pride or their envy, will blame shift, project, and refuse to own it. Therefore, there's, like the Pharisees, when Jesus talked to the Pharisees about their proud heart, they could not see it. They would not look at it, right? And then, so not only diagnostically are we looking for these seven things, but we want to see them therapeutically change, because we're looking for a change of heart, right? So when we're looking at abuser behavior, so I'll give you a case example, how we knew he was changing. Okay? So I worked with a couple. He was a policeman. He had lived a double life. He was a policeman and an elder at one life, and he was also going to strip joints and one-night stands in another life, and he did both. And when his wife found out, obviously she was very upset. He seemed repentant. How do you know? How do you know? Crying doesn't necessarily prove repentance. It just says he's upset. It doesn't say anything about what's going on in his heart, right? So he seemed repentant. So we worked separately, and he worked with his pastor, and I worked with her, and then I did some work with them as a couple. He had actually engaged in this behavior, for what he said, a while before, and then she found out later. So it had been some time that he had already been working on this with his pastor, and she just found out. So that was fresh for her. But anyway, so we labeled it a selfish heart, because he selfishly wanted all the perks of a great marriage, all the great perks of being the elder, and he wanted all the fun of being a sinner, right? He wanted both. And his selfish heart justified all that. So I'm looking, as Paul says, when he's talking about a thief, hey, thieves, steal so no more. In Ephesians, when he says, a thief changes, when a thief changed from a selfish heart to a generous heart by giving. He said, give to those in need, because a thief is a taker, right? And so he says, you're going to be a giver now. That's how I know a thief has changed. Not that you don't steal anymore, but that you're a giver. And so we were listening for his heart change. So they were on vacation, and if you've worked with any couples whose husbands have had sexual sins, you know vacations at the beach are not a good idea. So they took a vacation at the beach, and of course this made her very insecure, and she didn't like the fact that he might be looking at other women in their bathing suits, and so she was not having a good vacation. And she was complaining, and she was not being the fun wife that he wanted. And so he, in an outburst of anger, said, "Why do you have to go ruin my vacation?" What does that sound like? Selfish heart. Still there. He's not doing the other stuff, but he's doing this stuff. Still there. What was different is when he came to counseling, he said, "I see that the same old selfish heart that justified watching porn and going to these strip joints and all the other stuff is what happened when I lost my temper on vacation. And I still am struggling with selfishness." That's different, right? That's different, right? So that encouraged her. So he lost his temper, yes, but he saw he lost his temper and saw the root of it. And so it's sort of like weeds in your garden, you know? You pull the weeds out and they come back. And you pull them out. Every time I have this garden full of weeds and I, every time, pride, selfishness, pride. Because they come back, don't they? But if you're aware that when they're back, then you can be careful and pull them out again, then you're just an ordinary sinner, right? Then you're just like everybody else. When you refuse to own them and you excuse them or you justify them or you manipulate, that's when they're a problem. So we're looking for this change of heart, and you'll understand this better in the treatment program, but I just wanted to give you this list. All right, quickly. People affect and influence us. You know, I think sometimes we put an inordinate burden that somehow if somebody was really spiritual, if you were really strong and spiritual, you'd be able to take it. Like, stay with your husband because the sanctity of marriage is so important that your health and your mental health, Jesus will just take care of that. But actually, the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible says people do influence us, and they do affect us. It says, hang out with wise people because what? You'll become more like them. And if you hang out with angry people, you'll become more like them. And if you hang out with foolish people, you'll become more like them. Right? And so the people who we hang out with affect us. And I can't think of the verse, but I'm sure you'll all tell me where it's at. But it's in Proverbs where it says something about living with a contentious person is like rottenness to the bones. Right? So it affects your health. David was having that panic attack. I remember working with a woman who went to the doctor. She was living with a very angry and contentious, authoritative, hierarchical, patriarchal man, and they went to this very patriarchal homeschool church where everybody had to, you know, just kowtow to the men. And she tried. I mean, she was trying to do all that. It was a very scary, tense environment for her and her five children. And when she went to the doctor for a school physical for all of them, they all had high blood pressure, every one of them. And the doctor said, "What's going on at your house?" And that's what woke her up. Like, I can't hide from the effects that this is having on our health. All of us, even the little kids. So, Daniel Goleman again, who's a social scientist, says when someone dumps their toxic feelings on us, and this is what research in neuroscience is showing, explodes in anger or threats, shows disgust or contempt, they activate in us a circuitry for the very same distressing emotions. And so what often happens is you see this woman who's so emotionally distraught, she's looking a little nutty. It'd be tempting to label her borderline because she's so worn out and depleted. And so when he's sitting there cool as a cucumber and she's reactively all over the place, it's very tempting as pastors and counselors to see her as the problem and him being the victim, when actually it's quite different than that most of the time. So be careful, because when we tell a woman that somehow Jesus is going to give her the strength to endure, maybe Jesus is saying, go, and we'll talk about that a little bit. The consequences are not just physical, they're emotional, mental, relational, spiritual, and generational. And so I'm just going to show you a quick video that I just think illustrates this really well.
One month or two?
Five.
Certainly, darling.
Look what you did!
What?
You spilled!
I'm sorry, it's just a little bit.
Here you go again. Sorry.
What can I do?
You can't do anything because you can't do anything right!
I don't know what to do.
Just shut up!
It was a grave in your teeth!
how they say a picture tells a thousand words. Kids see this every single day. And maybe they don't see the physical part of it, but they hear the screaming, the yelling, the verbal vomit. And again, this is what Daniel Goleman says. Social Intelligence is the book that this is from. It talks about neuroscience now showing how people influence our circuitry inside. And here's what he says. Like a plant adapting to a rich or depleted soil, a child's brain shapes itself to fit its social ecology, particularly the emotional climate fostered by the main people in her life. Parenting cannot change every gene or modify every neural tick. And yet what children experience day after day sculpts their neural circuitry. Scary. It's scary that we're not paying attention to that. As a church, we ought to protect the children. We're saying, Jesus says, if anyone causes one of these little ones to stumble, if we keep them in a harsh, scary environment. I talked to a woman just the other day, and she said, I was so scared growing up. I was so scared. All I could think about was how to stay safe. I didn't learn my math facts. I didn't learn what I needed to learn at school because I was so scared at home. All I could think about was how to not get in trouble. How has she been robbed of what she could have been because she couldn't give any energy to growing up as a kid? It's not, should be. So, what are the strategies for treatment? So I'm going to start that before lunch, and then we're going to finish that after lunch, okay? All right. I told you before that one of my verses as I started my counseling practice was this in Jeremiah 6:14, where it says, because I felt like God was saying to me not to do this, you heal the wounds of my people by superficially promising peace, peace, when there is no genuine or lasting peace. Especially with couples in destructive marriage, reconciliation is hard work. Most couples will not do it because the destructive person will not do it. So I don't want to paint a magic picture here, but I want to show you the road ahead of what it looks like so that we're not saying, let's go have a date night. A date night will not fix this. More sex will not fix this. More couple time will not fix this. There's a specific strategy that will help fix this if someone's willing to walk in it. And if they're not, the marriage cannot be fixed. Then you have to decide what that does that mean, but it cannot be fixed. Martin Luther King said that true peace is not the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice. And I think that that's an important part. And the other thing that I just want to say, especially for those of you who are more theologically oriented, and all of you are Christians, but especially pastors maybe, because marriage is a picture. God created marriage to be a picture of the church and Christ. When we stay silent, when we know that Christian couples are so distorting that picture, that it's oppressor oppressed, and that's the model of Christ and the church that they're getting and they're portraying to their children, it's an abomination. An abomination. And we ought to be speaking about that so that even the children who are in those homes see that this isn't how it should be. This isn't a godly home. Okay, well then what is a godly home? Maybe I want a godly home. But when they're not told, and they're, this is what, and daddy's, you know, the pastor. I mean, recently I just talked to a woman whose husband was a pastor in a major church in the U.S. I'm not going to say where because it was public. But she fled with her kids, and when she came home, he had killed himself. And she was quite sure he would have killed her and the kids had she been there. This is an abomination that we're just not talking about. And so we really want to emphasize what is the picture of marriage that God portrays. And so these are the four stages of treatment. Safety, safety first. Always safety first. You don't do any treatment if there's no safety. You don't do any treatment of the couple if there's no safety. Right? How can someone be in marriage counseling if they're not safe to tell you the truth? So safety is the first treatment goal. I'll talk about that a lot. Sanity is the next treatment goal. Safety and sanity often go together. and you're talking together about those two things. So they sort of, it's not like one and then another. It's, they go together. But you can't even help someone build sanity if they're not safe. Okay? Safety, sanity, and then stability and security. So often in marriage counseling, we aim for stability and security before we've ever secured safety and sanity. All right? You cannot get stability to a marriage if there's no safety and there's no sanity. All right? So we really want to be clear on what that is. So let's start with safety. All right, safety is the first goal. And the Bible tells us the prudent see danger and take refuge. So we are going to validate her biblical right to safety. So we are going to assess for safety. We are going to look for places where she's not safe. And we are going to validate that God values, at least this is what I'm going to tell you, that God values the sanctity, God values the sanctity of marriage. He does, but not above the safety and the sanity of the people in it. So if we are prioritizing the sanctity of marriage and the individuals are disposable, I don't think that that's God's heart. God created marriage for the people in it and to portray the picture of Christ and his church. And when those two things are compromised, the picture's compromised and the people in it are not safe, why are we protecting the sanctity? We need to say this marriage is broken. I'm not saying it has to be divorced. It could be repaired if they're willing. But safety comes first. Now, let me just tell you my thinking on this. God has different priorities to his values, all right? Just like you do and I do. You know, like I value a clean house. But when my grandkids are visiting, it's a lesser priority than just hanging out and having fun, right? Because I want them to enjoy it. I don't want them to feel all nervous at grandma's house that they can't touch anything, you know? So when they leave, the house looks like a wreck, and it's okay with me because I value that grandma time more than having my house clean. I have both values, but one takes priority at certain times. All right, so God values certain things. He values honesty, for example. I mean, it's in the Ten Commandments. God says, do not bear false witness. And yet, there's a woman in the scriptures who lied, and she's actually in the Hebrews Hall of Fame. Do you remember who she is? Rahab. Rahab, she lied to protect their what? Safety. She lied to protect the Jews' safety from her own people. They went that way when she was hiding them over there. And she didn't tell the truth. I imagine when I was in Hungary a couple years ago speaking and I had a chance to visit the Holocaust Museum and saw all the different horrible things that happened during World War II, that Christians who hid Jews and Jewish things, if you saw the zookeeper's wife, you know, amazing acts of courage. They lied. They lied. Do you think God valued honesty more than safety? I don't think so. I think it's okay for them to lie. So that's one example. Here's another example. God values us respecting the authorities. He tells us to respect the authorities over us, to respect our government, to respect our spouse, to respect our church leaders. And yet, when those people are misusing that authority, we might not stay under their care. For example, when King Saul was seeking to harm David because he was jealous of him, God didn't tell David, well, David, you know, just trust me and I'll take care of you and obey Saul, he's your king. David fled, and it was okay with God that he fled. And David respected Saul when he could have killed him. He didn't overcome evil with evil. He overcame evil with good, but he still protected himself. How about when Jesus was a baby and the authority Herod wanted to kill all the children under two? And God woke, or the angel woke Joseph up in a dream, and he didn't say, hey, Joseph, I know Herod's trying to kill all the children, but just trust me, you'll be safe because I'm in control. He said, flee, flee. So God values safety, and God values the Sabbath. And the Pharisees so valued the orchestration of their rituals around the Sabbath that when Jesus did safety things or good, loving things like healing someone on the Sabbath, they wanted to kill him. Like, you broke our rules. And yet Jesus said to them, who of you, if your child or even your ox fell in a well, who wouldn't break the Sabbath? Why? For their safety, to pull them out. So for me, God values human beings' safety. And if they're in danger, the prudent see danger and take refuge. And so we need to validate a woman's right to safety. And I'm not just talking about physical safety. I'm talking about sexual safety. If her husband is sleeping around with a lot of different people, she may not want to be with him. And I think she has that right. What about her emotional safety? It says, guard your heart above all else, for it is the wellspring of life. But how many counselors tell a woman, well, you know what? You're being distant. You just need to be warm again and cold. And you're being cold. You just need to trust him again and forgive and open up your heart. She does not. When someone has trampled it, misused it, and abused it, without repentance on his part and real change, that would be foolishness. Or what about financial safety? So I had a woman who was staying well. She was trying to stay in this husband who was very indifferent to her. And she decided that as a Christian, she would try to stay well for lots of reasons, mostly because of, you know, the legacy to the grandkids and wanting to, you know, preserve family memories, and not bad ideas. And so she was trying to stay well. She was 60 years old. She was still working full time because they needed the money. He owned his own business. He worked out of the home. So she comes home from work, and she sees this big notice on her door from the IRS that they were seizing all of her assets and her home was going into foreclosure, whatever. And she was like, what is going on? Well, she found out, long story short, that her husband had taken all of their IRA money, all their retirement money, and he had spent it and never paid the taxes on pulling it all out early. And not only did he take that money, but she had inheritance money that her parents had given her in her own name and her own bank account. He forged her name and took all that. And when she confronted him on it, of course, he denied it. He said it was identity theft, and he didn't know what she was talking about. So they went through a lot of time trying to, you know, figure it all out. It turned out that, yes, he did take it, and yes, he was responsible. She was, like, owing hundreds of thousands of dollars to the IRS. She had no idea who this man was that she had been living with. He never disclosed what he did with all that money. Is she safe? She didn't want to sleep another night in that same house. She was terrified. I don't know who he is, what he did, what he's up to. I don't feel safe. Does that make sense? Would there anybody here who would say, no, you just need to go home and trust Jesus? I think Jesus showed her what she needed to do. He brought truth to light. And the prudent see danger and take refuge. So we need to help her develop a safety plan and validate her biblical right to safety. That's the first part of the treatment plan. So working with the victim. Let's just say we're working with the woman right now, because a lot of times you're not even working with the man yet. So I'm going to kind of talk about working with the woman, and I'll talk about working with the man and working with the couple, okay? And I'm assuming that you guys don't buy this, but there might be one or two of you who do. So let's just talk about this whole suffering thing, because suffering is a good biblical value, just like sanctity of marriage, right? Just like being a servant. They're all good biblical values, but we distort them somehow to make our case for something that's not appropriate. All right, so suffering is a good virtue. We are called to suffer. What are we called to suffer for? Suffer for righteousness. Suffer what else? So here's the verse people use. Sometimes Jesus calls us to lay down our life for our... No, greater man has no one that he laid down his life for his friends. What would you lay down your life for? I mean, would you lay down your life for anything? What would you lay down your life for? Children. Your children? With reservation. So if my child was a drug addict, I don't know if I would lay down my life for them, right? Unless they were getting hit by a car, then I might. But I wouldn't necessarily work harder to give them money to buy drugs, right? I wouldn't sacrifice to enable them, right? So we have to see, what are we laying down our life for? So what the biblical love mandate says is, if we're going to love someone, we're going to sacrifice or suffer for their good, right? For their good. So for our children, if my child was being eaten by a lion, I would put myself in the lion's mouth before I would let my kid be eaten by a lion, if I could, right? Or if my child was being hurt by someone, I would hurt myself before I would let that continue. Or if a child that I didn't even know was drowning, I would jump in and try to save them, even if I might die. Or if a woman was being raped on the street and I was standing by, I might try to get something and club the guy over the head or something, and he might shoot me. But that would be a virtuous death. That would be a virtuous sacrifice, a virtuous suffering. You're suffering for doing good. Even Jesus, when he went to the cross, he suffered and sacrificed for our good. He didn't do it all the time, though. There's plenty of places in Scripture where he said he knew what was in their hearts and he escaped. He knew they were plotting to hurt him and kill him, and he escaped. Remember those passages? Okay, so we don't always suffer and sacrifice. We only do it when it's for someone's good. So when we ask a woman to suffer and sacrifice in order to enable her husband to continue to hurt her, what sounds crazy about that to you? Is that for her good? Is it for his good? Is it for their children's good? Is it for their marriage good? It's not for anybody's good. So why do we ask her to do that? It's not for anybody's good.